This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KABC.com. I am Alan Gervie, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. And today, as usual, on this fine Sunday afternoon, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And I'm here with my talented and intellectual.
There we go. I like that one. That's a first.
I know. I think I have to take a lie detector test on that.
Dare you.
I'm sorry.
Dare you.
I was going to say very talented and very
tenacious.
Beautiful, tenacious.
There we go.
So much going on with you.
I know.
Carrie Kasem.
That's me.
Live in studio.
Right here.
Right here.
Right here. I just got off of this whole week. I did 3 days at a conference, Worlds, which is this huge CEO, CMO, like, I mean, 2,500 people. Then 2,000 people yesterday at Driven, another conference I hosted and spoke at.
Wow.
It's been pretty crazy.
I know you were talking about Driven. Isn't that the one with Tim Story that you were
talking
about?
Tim was there, and then also Albert and Sylvia Preciado. It's their thing. But yes, Tim, our friend here.
Yeah, he had a great show a few weeks ago, and we've got some great shows coming up in the next few weeks. And, of course, today is an exceptional show. I describe the shows past and future as great. Today I'm describing it as exceptional.
Yes.
Because I think it's intriguing to so many people when you talk about sentencing. We talk about judges, what judges do. I always, I think I get the most nervous when I'm getting assigned a judge at court because it really can dictate what the case will go, how the case will go, actually.
Sure.
The fact of the matter is that I'm so confident in my abilities to represent my client, but I'm not really confident about what that judge is thinking. In fact, this week I was actually threatened with contempt of court.
Come on. For what?
I kind of mimicked what the other attorney was doing. She was really going crazy with her arms, and there was a lot of people in the courtroom, and I kind of put up my arms as she was going crazy.
You, like, flailed them?
Well, she was flailing. She was out of control.
I've and seen lawyers judge, like that.
The judge said to me, Mr. Gervie, I'm going to find you in contempt. And I said, what? I'm just getting excited about this case. If my colleague there on the other side can get excited by throwing her arms up in the air and doing all... She was dancing, actually. I don't know what she was doing. She had ants in her pants. And he didn't buy it for a second. So
wow.
I calmed down. I quickly calmed down. I put my hands in my pants.
Did people laugh?
Everyone was laughing, and they knew exactly
what you were doing.
When I looked at the other people, there were other lawyers in there. It was just other people. They were rolling their eyes when the other attorney was speaking. So I thought I had license to do whatever I wanted to do
now,
in
she,
front of the judge.
Did she stop afterwards?
She went crazy.
And when you did that?
Yeah, went crazy.
She didn't, like,
no,
go,
no,
oh, you know what?
She got worse.
Oh.
She got worse.
Oh.
But, you know, I'll tell you, it's a really difficult job being a judge. And today we are fortunate enough to have one of the best, a federal judge. He got his commission from President Bill Clinton to sit on the U.S. District Court for Eastern District of New York in 1994. And before that, he was in private practice approximately 30 years doing civil and criminal practice. He has had such a career in being on the bench for cases like sentencing the Gambino crime family boss, Peter Gotti, and when there was post 9/11 attacks addressing whether ethnicity can be used to establish criminal propensity, he was on the bench. There are a number of cases that he had been involved with. Lemrick Nelson is a well-known case which had to do with Crown Heights riots. Jabbar Collins, convicted murdering of an Orthodox rabbi, in prison for 15 years, but it was a wrongful conviction. And then I think a case that I'm sure he will like to speak about, Shavile Nesbitt, which is in the book of the that we're going to talk about today. He's written three books, Crimes and Punishments, Entering the Mind of a Sentencing Judge, came out in June. A fascinating read. And the foreword is by none other than your favorite, Erwin Chemerinsky. Every time I mention him, you get excited because you love when he's on the show. He's on the show frequently.
He's great.
I wrote a great foreword in that. Disrobed, an inside look at the life and work of a federal trial judge. And that was in 2012. And then his entry in the fiction arena, Race to Judgment, a fantastic book with great reviews in 2017. He co-authored an off-Broadway musical, Professionally Speaking, back in 1985. And he's been active playing the piano and writing music. We are honored today to have with us Judge Frederick Block. Welcome to Gervie's Law.
Well, after that introduction, I'm glad I'm here. Kerry, you appeared before 2,500 people this week. I just had about three or four people before me. Unfortunately, I had to put them all in jail.
Oh, no. Well, yeah, I didn't have to do that. And I don't think anybody that was in front of us. Oh, that I lie. There were a part of the one of the events I was at were these reformed convicts. And they actually were part of a marketing group. So I was around reformed criminals. A little different.
Yeah.
And you know, that's...
One of the fallouts of writing books is sometimes you can get really embarrassed. A couple of weeks ago, I sentenced somebody to jail for 2 years, and the last thing he did before the marshals hauled them off was they asked me whether they could give him an autographed copy of Race to the Judgment.
That's a great request.
And did you?
Absolutely. I think I'm well known in the jails here.
Oh, wow.
You know, when you do those autographs, Judge Block, you know, you have to write something. When you've just sentenced someone, what do you write in the book at the beginning when you're going to autograph it? What do you write to the guy?
Well, when do you see the autograph I'm going to give you after the show?
I'm afraid to see it. You know,
I'll be happy to.
That'd be great. You know, fascinating read. And all these things that you've done, you sit here and, you know, you're a young fella. You've got a lot ahead of you, I know, with your writing and judging. What do you feel most proud of when you look back on your career?
Well, I think that a lot of this is, well, here's what I reflect upon. Whatever I did to get this judgeship, I look back, and not one of these things I did that I make a penny on. They were all sort of volunteer work. They were all not-for-profit things. They were all just new good projects, and none of them brought me any money whatsoever. So it dawns upon me that the quality of your life really doesn't depend upon your economic wherewithal. It depends on something else, how you feel. You have to have a passion for what you do. I lectured to lawyers all the time. If you don't have a passion for the law, you're in the wrong business. And I never really anticipated that I would be talking to you today. And I practiced law, and I just went my way and tried to do the best that I could. I didn't have any particular aspirations for a judicial career. It just came my way. But I really think that I'm here today because I really had a passion for the law. And it sounds kind of silly to say that, but, you know, I see so many lawyers who just hate what they do.
Right.
They work for big corporate law firms. They do discovery. They do a lot of things. They work these godless hours, and they're not happy. So, you know, it's good to see that you're doing pretty well for yourself.
Well, we appreciate that. But, you know, you hit on a key word when you say passion. Anything that you've done has shown so much passion. Yet, when you were talking to Sam Reisman, who was actually on our show last week, he's a writer for Law 360, and you were talking about sentencing, you said, people down in Washington sentenced you. I'm just telling you what the sentence is. Explain what you mean by that.
All right. So, you know, one of the things I wrote in the new book, I have a section about mandatory minimum sentences. So Congress really, really controls judges more than the public realizes. People think it's the other way around, but that's really not the case. Congress fixes our salary. Congress establishes the laws that we have to adhered to, and Congress sets mandatory minimum sentences. And they do this by and large in drug cases, and the current passion that they have is in child pornography cases. So we don't really like child pornographers. Nobody likes child pornographers, but this sentences that are imposed by Congress require a mandatory minimum of 5 years or 15 years, and there are a lot of other statutes which carry mandatory minimums. I think about 13% of all sentences that we have carry mandatory minimums, so I don't really create those sentences. It's Congress that's doing that. So when I tell Sam Reisman, I tell people when I sentence them pursuant to mandatory minimum that I'm just the mouthpiece. I'm just the messenger. Congress is really sentencing you. And I think that, you know, it's troublesome that you take away the discretion from the judge who has the knowledge and the background to really render a fair judgment. And you let the politicians down in Washington decide, because it's politically sexy, perhaps, to set these sometimes enormously high sentencing mandatory minimums. So that's what I was railing against. And that's what really got me really upset when I was writing that particular chapter in the book, which is, I think, a good, pretty good read.
Now, what if you didn't sentence somebody to a minimum sentence? Like, you just broke the rules. You said, I'm not going to do that. What can happen there?
Yeah, well, the government will take an appeal to the Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Circuit Court of Appeals will reverse my sentence and send it back for resentencing. Kerry, you have to understand that sentencing is carried on by the district court judges, right, not the Circuit Court judges, not the Supreme Court of the United States. So we're the ones that really are the ones that have to fix the sentence. I mean, you talk about being a district court judge, the most compelling part of what we do is sentencing, because that's the one that allows for the most amount of discretion by a particular judge. And the sentences vary all over the place. I can give you a sentencing dynamic, and I can present it to 10 different people, and you'll come up with 10 different results.
Wow.
What does that say for our criminal justice system? It's frightening, and it shows you why sentencing is the most important part of what the federal court does, in my opinion. All the other cases, there are statutes, you apply them, you try to get them right, you're either right, you're either wrong, but sentencing, wow, you can just, you know, have a field day here, and it's really troublesome. I don't think people really truly realize how difficult it is to do that, and hopefully this little book I wrote will open up a lot of doors.
And it is a fascinating read, and when you talk about the different elements and aspects of sentencing, it really helps to read a book like Crimes and Punishments, entering the mind of a sentencing judge to understand more about it. You are a doctor, a juris doctor. Judge Block, we have to take a break right now. It's getting very exciting, because after the break, we need to talk about Shavelle Nesbitt. Kerry alluded to it. What do you do when maybe you don't follow the guidelines? In that case, the sentencing guidelines was 33 to 41 months. Stay tuned to find out what Judge Block sentenced Shavelle Nesbitt for and why. That's the key thing. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. Yeah, we're back.
This is a great song.
Right here on Gervie's Law, a little country action.
A little country about jail.
There is a connection there. We're talking to Judge Frederick Block. Now I made him a Supreme Court.
You were going to say justice.
Yeah. Well, he sounds like he's...
So far I've been justice. I've been doctor.
This is...
Yeah. You mentioned songwriting, so I've written a lot of country songs.
Have you?
You know, it's interesting, because I loved what you said when you're competing with John Grisham. You said, but can he write music? And yeah, you can write music, especially country music.
I wish we could play some of your stuff. That'd be great.
Wow. You can stream it on any streaming device. The first song I ever wrote years ago is She Was a Cheap Date, But Look What She's Costing Me Now. So Race to Judgment
That's a great one.
It's going to be made into a TV series and be the next Game of Thrones. We have a great scriptwriter, a fellow named John McLaughlin, who wrote the movie Black Swan. Mm. He just finished the script, and we're going to be coming out to L.A. I'll stop by and say hello, and we're going to be pitching this to Netflix and the networks, and it's based upon my novel, Race to Judgment. And in that book, we have music. So the protagonist sings my country songs, and you can even find it in the appendix. The charts are all there. You can stream it, Kerry. After you finish talking to me today, just stream on my Frederick Block. You'll find me all over the place, and you can listen to my country music. So,
I will.
Anyway, let's
talk
about Cheryl Nesbitt, because, you know, I have this other life. I do a lot of writing. I'm blessed with a little bit of creative ability, and I feel pretty good about that. But, you know, it's not as important as when we sit and pass judgment on another human being.
So,
and Cheryl Nesbitt. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say Senator Block. we heard you.
I'll be running against Trump pretty soon.
I haven't said president.
Not yet.
I won't go that far.
Not yet.
We spoke earlier today when in the first segment when you talked about the sentencing guidelines, and yet there is a perception that judges can vary in sentencing greatly, notwithstanding the sentencing guidelines that may be governmental. When you talk about your Brooklyn upbringing, what is it from your upbringing that people may think goes into some of the decisions that you make with sentencing?
Well, you know, if somebody's a good baseball player, of course they get off.
There you go. Finally an honest judge.
They're beating the Dodgers right now, so that, you know, is of course a big factor.
Dodgers are going to come back. I can see it.
Yeah, they got some team. But the Mets, you know, interesting team, too. But we don't want to talk about the Mets right now. And if they don't win, I'll sentence them all to jail. But
there you go.
Point.
Well, you should be a Dodger fan, by the way, from your old days
Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn.
My bar mitzvah, I was at Ebbets Field when I was 13 years old, watching Howie Paulette shut out the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Wow. And what a great bar mitzvah.
What a great memory.
Yeah. And
we digress. Tell us about your upbringing and how you came to your thoughts and this sparkling personality. Where'd that come from? Your parents?
I don't know, Alan. You're just born with what you're born with, you know, and I wonder how much we're able to really determine the shape of our lives, maybe to some extent, but I think a lot of it is part of the DNA. And, you know, my mother came from Philly in the roof country, and, you know, they had that trip, you know, long time ago when they came to this country.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, being raised, you know, by parents who had to suffer that way, it's got to have an impact on you. So, look, the whole thesis behind this new book is that, you know, when we go ahead and make judgments, we're aware of the law as judges. You know, we have a conscious awareness of the guidelines, but we don't really have a real good sense of what may be subliminally at work, or what are our conscious thoughts are. They're there. I mean, your life story impacts, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it, how you turn out in terms of a judge. You hope that you have a good moral compass, and you just, you know, pray that, you know, you have good sound judgment, and you're not overly oppressive. I mean, when people go to jail, we have these telephone numbers, 15 years, 5 years, 25 years, easy to mouth that. But, you know, when people have to do the time, it's no joke at all. And I think that if you have some doubts about how to sentence somebody, you should definitely err on the side of being a little bit more cautious than a little bit more oppressive. And I think you need some sensitivity training to really be mindful of the fact you're dealing with human lives here. So I don't want to go on and on and on about that, but, you know, I basically don't have an actual formula about how I sentence. I just hope that because I was raised the way I was raised, with, I think, a decent moral compass, that I do a pretty decent job. I put some people in jail for a long time also. I mean, I put people who, you know, were engaged in sex trafficking in jail for 50 years. So I don't think I'm a soft touch. But, you know, you still have to be open-minded and sensitive to the plight of the human being. And Cheryl Nesbitt was that perfect case. So in Crimes and Punishment, I carve out 6 or 7 scenarios where a judge has to deal with how you go about sentencing a public figure, for example. And Cheryl Nesbitt is a perfect example of what a judge does in that situation. I read a book that made an impression on me at the same time that Cheryl's case was being tried.
But, I want to interrupt you because I can. I can't in court, but right now I can. And
you have a right to do that.
I would never do it if I were standing before you in court. But, you talk about the impact that things have on you, on a judge, for instance. And I know where you're going with this. You read a book. The book's The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. Right. Are we to, and you can tell us about it, but are we to expect that what a judge reads will impact how the sentencing goes, for instance, in a criminal case? And I think it's more than that, because it's not just, people think it may just be about a sympathetic judge or not, but you really had a method to your madness after reading that book with Chevelle Nesbeth on that case to try and do something better, not only for her, but for all society as a whole.
Yeah, well, it's nice to say that, but after 22, 23 years of being ignorant about this, it opened my eyes. I was almost ashamed of myself that it took me that long to realize what this world of collateral consequences was all about. And that's exactly what happened. But what you read, what you eat, who you talk to, what you do, all of these human factors, which obviously are part of the subconscious that enters into your decision-making process. And we should be aware of that. We should check ourselves out. Are we making a decision based upon emotionality, or is there reason or logic to it? To what extent may have had some situations in my life, my brother committed suicide on drugs. Mm. To what extent does that play out when I sentence somebody on drugs? I have to question myself about that all the time, because naturally that impacts you. And everybody has life stories that are going to affect their judgment. So I think to be sensitive about that, to be mindful about it, to be mindful of the fact that there may be unconscious subjective things that play in the course of your lifetime, I think is what really the theme is of the book that I really tried to write, to reach out to the public, to let them know that judges really have to take a hard look at their upbringing and what their prejudices might be, and try to level the playing field as best as you can. So much for that. I don't know whether you want to hear about collateral consequences or not, and we can talk about.
Why don't you touch on, because it is fascinating, and you said it took you many years to really understand and appreciate the concept. There are a lot of listeners right now that don't know what you're talking about. I know when I read about it, I was fascinated, because I think it's something that people should understand. And it's not simply empathy. When you're giving someone a sentence of 1 year probation, community service, instead of perhaps 33 months in prison, there's something more to it. You're doing something when you're looking at collateral consequences, something more than just being an empathetic person.
Yeah. So let me cut to the chase. So Chevelle was, I think, 19 to 20 years old. She was going to college. She was, a straight-A student. She was planning to become a teacher or a principal. She had a perfect record. She worked in the summer helping young kids out. She was an ideal young human being who had a bad hair day. She had a boyfriend. She went down to Jamaica to visit her father. She came back with drugs in a suitcase. She went to trial. She was guilty as hell as far as I'm concerned, but she gave it the good old college try. A jury convicted her, appropriately so. I had a sentence. And so, at that same time, I happened to be reading Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. And she just, alerted me to the fact that you had these collateral consequences. People served their jail time. What happens afterwards? And then I read a study by the ABA that really shocked me. There are over 50,000 state-by-state collateral consequences in the state courts. There's 170-some-odd in the federal court. What that means is the following. You're out of jail. You've done your time, a year, 6 months, whatever it is. You try to get a driver's license, you can't get a driver's license. You try to get public housing, you can't get public housing. You try to get employment, you can't get employment. You try to get food stamps, you can't get food stamps. My God. So the research I did, I got my law clerks on top of this thing, stunned me when I realized all these tack-on types of liabilities and limitations people have after they've served their time. And the recidivist rate is 80%. No wonder you can't get a job. You really can't go on with your life. And so I wrote about that. And that was the necessary case. I did not put her in jail. You know, certainly she was punished. You know, I put her on probation and all sorts of home confinement and things of this nature. But I didn't incarcerate her because I felt that she was being punished enough by reason of the fact that she could not engage in being a teacher anymore. Mm-hmm. Her whole life is being ruined because of all of these consequences that attach to a conviction by state law and by federal law. So I try to make the public aware of this, and I try to make the judges aware of this. And I think it's a sentencing factor. So when you sentence somebody, you can and you're supposed to consider a lot of variables. The good deeds that a person may do, their life story, so to be, what kind of a personal character do they have, and you mix it all together.
Yeah.
And I think that when you deal with these collateral consequences, it should be part of the sentencing dynamic. That's what I wrote about.
It's fascinating. Fascinating. We got to take
if anybody's going to read. Yeah, if anybody's going to read the book, read that last chapter. Go ahead, take a break.
Yeah, no, we got to take a break. But, you know, I was just reading one of the reviews there. It's wonderfully reviewed. And the reviewer writes, the author masterfully weaves into the narrative countless war stories and personal experiences that he countered in the profession before he joined the bench. And that's just what you're talking about. All of these experiences put together get you to the mindset where you can be the sentencing judge. The book's Crimes and Punishments, Entering the Mind of a Sentencing Judge. You're listening to Gervais Law. We're talking to the man, Frederick Block, Justice, Judge, Doctor, Senator. We just call him a friend of the show. You're listening to Gervais Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. All right. I'm not sure there's parties in the county jail, but...
Yeah, I like the music.
It is good music. It's not exactly country, but, you know, I guess Elvis could be considered twangy. We're talking to Judge Frederick Block, federal judge. And real quick question for you. Next week we have Ben Brofman on our show. And I know you were writing something a couple years back called Radical Justice. Whatever happened to that? Wasn't there a character based on him? And maybe you can give me some insight in what I should ask him when he's on the show.
I don't know how you found that out. That's a book that I started. I never finished. The one I'm doing right now is going to be a pretty cool book. So I know Ben. Ben had, I think, his first real major high-profile win before me. He represented a guy named Peter Gation, who was called the King of Clubs. He owned all these hot nightclubs in New York City, and he was being prosecuted in the 90s for running what the government thought was a drug emporium. All the kids were getting stoned there. And, you know, he was a great, great lawyer. It was his first big win. You speak to him and tell him Judge Block to this day tells people that of all the trials he's had, the finest criminal defense lawyer he's ever experienced here, with maybe the exception of my good friend Steve Zissou, is Ben Brofman.
You know, that's very interesting.
If I kill Kerry, he's the one I'm going to hire to represent me.
That's a good one. Yeah. So, you know, because Steve Zissou is actually going to join us in a couple minutes. So I'm really glad that you actually pointed that out, that Ben would be second on the list, maybe behind Steve, because, you know, I don't want. And when we talk to Steve first, we don't want to say that he's putting Ben ahead of you're putting Ben ahead of Steve. Someone has a question here. Jeff, you're in Texas. You're talking
hey, how
to the
you
judge.
Doing, Your Honor? How you doing, Jeff? Well, you know, hanging in there. You know how it is. Life just throws punches at you.
Are you in prison, Jeff?
Oh, heck no.
Okay, good.
Quite the opposite. I'm in Texas. I'm a RN. I'm a heavy trauma RN. Do cath lab, do all kinds of stuff. I'm constantly having to put my foot down against the hospitals to protect the patients due to being the law in my practice and my scope of my license. But the bad thing is with that, I've had to protect my patients, but it's cost me my job, which I don't have, you know, too much problem with, because I can always say, you know, I can always get another job. I can't get another license. But the problem is that now it's kind of tarnished my reputation, not in the sense that.
What happened?
What happened? Oh, there he is.
Me. sorry, they're retaliating against me. And basically, it put it like a scarlet letter on my back. And I was wondering if you think that I have any chance of getting a case for possible defamation or collusion, since now that I've been out of the job for 6 months. But luckily, in my career, I saved a lot and it paid very well. But still, I'm kind of mad because now I'm still young. I'm only 27. And now I'm basically kind of wondering, what do I do now?
So this is kind of like a people's court question.
Yeah, it is.
It's nothing to do with sentencing. But, you know, you have a very bright man who's got a lot of experience on the phone. Judge Block, what would be your quick advice for Jeff?
Well, first, you need a lawyer, and a good lawyer. We get a lot of discrimination cases in court where people who lose their jobs. And under the federal law, if you're fired because of age or national origin or sexual orientation or your color, then you could come marching to federal court and yell foul. And we get some of these cases where people are successful and some where they're not successful. So I don't know the specifics of your case, Jeff. I mean, if I were a lawyer, I can't practice law anymore. I would have to sit down with you for 3 or 4 hours and get the whole story to really learn all the facts. But you really need to consult with a lawyer. I know in New York, where, you know, I practice law and I'm now a judge, they have very good bar associations. You can call the city bar up and they will be able to find a lawyer for you to talk to. I don't know what Texas is all about in that respect, but I would check out the bar association.
You know, Judge,
you really want to talk to a lawyer.
Judge Block, you gave some great advice there. You said I'd sit down 3 hours with you and figure out what's going on. And that's what a lot of times judges have to do when they're considering these cases. Just from hearing you, people will understand what goes into some of these decisions, such as sentencing. And, you know, it's so important when people understand, you don't take it lightly, do you?
No, but, you know, let me say one thing, Al. This is very important, because when you hear that a judge has written a book about emotions, subjective things, what goes on in your mind, entering the mind of the judge, giving shoulders but no jail time, hey, this must be one of those pink old liberal judges, you know, we're going to get rid of him, right? But it's just the opposite, because what I really feel pretty good about here is that if you look at the back of the cover of Crimes and Punishments, I've got, you know, kudos from the most conservative commentators in the world, Michelle Malkin, who says this is a terrific book, everybody should read it. And I try to balance those comments out between so-called liberal, so-called conservative people. The Heritage Foundation praised my decision in the Nesbitt case, because solid people, be they liberal or conservative, should always really be human beings. It's not a matter of being a liberal or a conservative, but how do you exercise sound judgment? And it's not an issue of liberal or conservative. It's something else that's in the water. So I feel really proud about the fact that what I wrote here has crossed the so-called ideological waters here. And, you know, so I feel really pretty good about that. I just want to make that point. It's very important.
It is an important point.
When you hear about a judge sentencing somebody not in jail, you know, he's one of those fuzzy liberal guys, but it's not the case here.
And, you know, when you think about the scales of justice and justice being blind, this is a great example that you give when you're weighing the evidence and you're looking at it for sentencing as well. You can look at it when you... when you're really doing a full explanation, description of what you're trying to get across, that's really where I think this comes into play. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to try and track down Steve, your buddy, because we have some good news to tell him from what you've said, Judge Block.
And I have to say that I was looking at all your books and Race to Judgment with all the music. One of my friends gave you like a testimonial, James Barber. Do you know him?
Jimmy, absolutely.
Yes. Oh, my God. He's been a dear friend of mine forever. Jim Barber. No, he's a Broadway star, Phantom of the Opera.
Really?
Yeah.
He was Phantom for 2 years.
Yeah.
Carrie, you got to listen to the music.
I will. I'm a huge Broadway person, so this is fantastic.
You know, Judge Block, I don't know where she comes by this music thing. You know, all of a sudden she's into music. Growing up with Casey Kasem, I don't know if that had anything to do
Nothing
with it.
Nothing at all, no.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to try and get Steve Zissou. We got to find him.
We'll track
him down.
We got
some good news for you.
We're going to track him down.
You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Wake up early morning, I got court tomorrow. Ooh. I ain't breaking out the old school till it's up the par. Ooh. Ain't gonna stop top of our mama.
Well, this is a far cry from Jailhouse Rock. But I think there's a theme there. Yeah, there's a theme of the jail thing going on. We're talking to Judge Frederick Block, federal judge. Real quickly, I know you can't comment on a lot of ongoing issues. What's this business with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Twitter account and the lawsuit brought by Dov Hykind, the former assembly member? Are you involved with that?
Yeah, you know, I'm impressed. You guys have really done your homework. So there was a major case decided here by the Circuit Court of Appeals out in New York, the Second Circuit, a couple of months ago that said that the President of the United States can't block somebody from having access to his Twitter account and take an issue with whatever he may be saying. So as if that decision was rendered, Dov Hykind, who is the leader of the Hasidic community in New York, brought this lawsuit against Ocasio-Cortez, who's a really highly regarded, progressive, young, very talented woman who's made national news. And he called her an anti-Semite. And she took offense to that, and she blocked him from having access to a Twitter account. And that's the lawsuit that he brought. That's pending before me. Actually, this week, I scheduled the hearing to find out exactly what her Twitter account is all about and what she uses it for, and to give everybody an opportunity to tell me what the facts are all about. But basically, it's a constitutional issue. To what extent can you preclude somebody from exercising their rights to speak, even if it's something you're not really happy with? And so it's a hot button issue. And yeah, you're right. That's the case I'm going to have to decide.
What do you think about it? I mean,
you can't ask.
I guess he's the judge. I just think it sounds ridiculous to me. I'm sorry. It just sounds frivolous and time wasting.
Once it's resolved,
well, you read my decision.
That's right.
Yeah, I know. I can't wait to. I just don't understand it.
We're going to have you back on, and after we read your decision, because I think it's important. It has some far-reaching consequences for a lot of people in the social media era. I think you know that, so it's a real important issue. Let's get Steve Zissou on here. Steve, we are having such a great time talking to your buddy, Judge Block. I'm sure you're not supposed to say it, but I did hear once that a good lawyer knows the law and a great lawyer knows the judge. So apparently Steve Zissou, who's a criminal defense attorney, former Queens County prosecutor, been involved with a lot of very well-known, high-profile cases. Don't have time to go through all of them now, but maybe we will on another day. Steve, tell us about Judge Block and how do you have such a great relationship? But I must say, before you get to it, we do have some good news for you, Steve. We just heard in the last half hour that you are the number one attorney in Judge Block's mind. You are ahead of Ben Brafman, who is our guest next week. And I have to break the news to Ben Brafman that Judge Block feels that Steve Zissou is on the number one, Ben being number two. So congratulations on that.
Well, that's high praise, and I'm sure he's correct too.
Tell us a little bit about your experience with Judge Block.
Well, it's interesting because I think we started to become friends some time ago. It was more than 20 years when I tried a capital murder in front of him that we call the blind shooter. And the client was acquitted of all accounts. And just to show you, any of your listeners think that he's some sort of a softy, he was very upset at the verdict. And my recollection was he sat on the acquittal order for a number of days before he finally signed off on it. But from that point onward, we started to develop a respect and eventually became friends. And he's more than just a friend. He's just a wonderful judge. And what I think your listeners should understand is the main reason why this book, Crimes and Punishments, is so important is the way in which federal sentencing is conducted. Your listeners probably don't know, but when you plead guilty in federal court, the judge doesn't make you a promise. It's not like state court where you know ahead of time what the result is going to be. If you plead guilty to a 20-year offense, meaning an offense for which you're facing up to 20 years in jail, when you come back for sentencing, the judge decides the sentence. He can give you anywhere from 0 to 20. So when you have a judge writing a book who is communicating to lawyers, litigants, law students, certainly, what he's thinking, it is unbelievably important. This should be a must read for everyone who even comes close to a courtroom. And so when you're, and look, I should say most federal judges don't give you that time of day. I mean, you have no idea what they're thinking until you show up. And that's what makes Judge Bok's willingness to put his thoughts down on paper so important, because it allows the lawyers and litigants to really prepare for the sentence proceedings when they come up.
You know, it's interesting, Judge Bok. Steve brings up a great point. When you talk about should you be speaking in public, there's a lot of different thoughts on that. Judge Edward Posner from Chicago talks about speaking in public as much as he can because he thinks it's important. Steve makes a good argument for it. Take the devil's advocate here and say, why wouldn't you speak in public? We have Gloria Allred on our show quite often, and she always says, I'm going to talk because my clients can't. But a judge doesn't have to.
Yeah. So, you know, look, judges acquire a lot of information over the years. They know it a lot. And I find that the public doesn't really have a clue about what we're all about, what federal court's about, what sentencing is all about, and on and on and on, how you become a judge. I think I read one place that 10% of the public thinks judge duties are United States Supreme Court justice. So I think that judges have a moral obligation to really speak out and try to educate the public in a proper, respectful way. I think that the public will have more respect for the judiciary if judges do that rather than less respect, as long as you do it, you know, in a very, very productive, you know, positive way. And I think that it's important. If you have an issue and you're involved with a judge and you can make a contribution by writing about collateral consequences and sensitizing people to what that's all about, I think you have an obligation to do that. There are other judges who do not share that thought. I may be in the minority. Richard Posner's a great believer in that. I think Cardozo was a great believer in that. I think Leonard Hand was. Anyway, I flip on that side of the equation. The more I know, I think I have an obligation to share it with the public, and I think some positive good can come of it. So I feel strongly about that.
And Steve makes a good point when he talks about the education part of it. Ironically, last night I was at a party, and I was with a judge that I appear before, and we are friends, and we spent a lot of time talking last night, and we were with our wives and everything. Steve talks about, you know, having a friendship with you. Steve, is there anything wrong with that? Do you feel a little strange if you have a case in front of Judge Bok, or when you've had cases in front of him? Do you feel that your personal relationship actually will help you or hinder you?
Well, look, so since I know he's this exceedingly fair fellow to all sides, and he really, you know, no one should expect anything but his fairest, most honest judgment. But I think recently what we've decided is it's time for me to it's time for me not to have cases before him anymore, only because of the appearance of impropriety. And it was a very difficult thing because appearing before him is just a joy, and he really is the kind of judge that look, again, your readers may know, the 94 federal districts, there's over 600 federal judges, and to have a judge who's welcoming, fair, direct, he puts people at ease, but really cuts to the heart of the issues and does it in a way that gives everybody an opportunity to really convince him as to their position. I'm going to miss that, but our friendship is infinitely more important than that. So I can't say it was a struggle over the years. It was just an absolute joy, and our friendship continues.
You know, you
so,
talk.
You know, we know a lot of people, Alan. So, you know, I don't accuse myself just because I know somebody and I see them at the Bar Association or even if I'm friendly with them. But if I get to the point where I feel, you know, a little bit of discomfort, then I have to recuse myself. And, you know, it's a shame because, you know, I really miss not having Steve in court, but I decided that I don't think I can handle his cases anymore because our friendship is too strong. So, you know, you have to call these. It's your judgment call. You try to do the best you can. I'm going to miss him in court. He was a wonderful lawyer, but I'm not going to handle his cases anymore.
You know, I think you talk about objectivity, and that's what Steve alludes to, is that the respect there, if you're going to give Judge Bok a decision or a sentence that affects his client, and I'm talking about in the past, obviously, he's going to respect that because of your history, because of what goes into these decisions. When you read the book Crimes and Punishments, Entering the Mind of a Sentencing Judge, you understand all of these factors that go into it. And as a defense attorney, Steve, you're an advocate. You're trying to sway a judge one way or another. Do you believe that you have that kind of control over judges, or sometimes all you can do is present the facts?
You know, I can say that a number of Judge Block's colleagues are kind of like him. They're really open-minded. They don't make their complete decision until they listen to both parties, and then they make a fair and reasoned decision. But I really do think that for the vast majority of his colleagues, they come to the bench already knowing what they're going to do, and the oral argument and the appearances of court are really just an exercise in futility. Judge Block, a handful of his colleagues, are the exception. Judge Block really listens. He doesn't, you know, he may have a sense of the range of punishment he's going to impose, but he really listens carefully to both sides before he makes decisions. And I'm sure you can ask him how many times he's changed his mind based on the oral argument, and I'll bet he'll say it's at least 50% of the time.
Well, not only on the oral argument, but on reading a book like The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. There's a lot of things that go into the decisions. And, Steve, we appreciate you being on the show. We'd love to have you on talking about some of your well-known cases. There's so many fascinating people that you've represented and a lot of instances that I'm sure a lot of the listeners would like to hear about, especially with respect to the terrorists that you've or alleged terrorism. And of course, Bryant Neal Vinas, the American Al Qaeda trainee. Interesting story. So hopefully you can come on with us another time. Steve, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored to be on with my dear friend Judge Block. Thank you.
As for you, Judge Block, and I called you Judge Block, what a pleasure it's been this last hour having you on the show. It's just, it's amazing listening to how forthright you are and your personality. It allows someone to really believe what you're saying. Thank you so much for being on Gervie's Law today.
And when are you coming back? When are you actually coming to Los Angeles?
Terry, you know, I want to warn you, I'm going to be out here pitching my TV show.
Yeah, when?
Say hello. Probably in a few weeks, you know, I'm going to be out there. We hope to get a Netflix deal or one of those big shots, and I'm pretty confident we will. I also sit on the Circuit Court of Appeals in your California. So I'll be out there in January in Pasadena. I'll be out there in May in San Francisco, and hopefully we'll be able to hook up.
Yeah, we'd love to have you in the studio.
You got to come in. We know some big shots. We know some machers out here. So we'll get you hooked up.
I'll let you know when I'm going to be out there. I have a great lawyer, you may know Lee Phillips. He's the great entertainment lawyer with Manette Phelps and Phillips.
Bring him in.
And,
yes.
You're not going to. This is not the end of Judge Block.
All right.
I enjoy
the book.
The
book is Crimes and Punishments. Go get it. Thanks for listening to Gervie's Law. We'll see you next week.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.